Welcome to the first episode of the FAIR Podcast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of the FAIR Podcast. In this episode, I'll be talking with Greg Smith, a FAIR volunteer and family care physician who lives in Canada. Greg has done a lot of writing on the FAIR Wiki and has published several responses to books in the Farms Review. His 2009 FAIR Conference presentation, Everything You Wanted to Know About Plural Marriage But Were Afraid to Ask, is available at fairlds.org. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. Welcome to the inaugural podcast for FAIR, the Foundation of Apologetic Information Research. I'm here with Greg Smith from Canada. Hello, Greg.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became an apologist.
I was born and raised in southern Alberta in Canada. Southern Alberta was settled by... or a lot of little towns here were settled by Mormons who headed north from Utah kind of in the 1880s in the wake of the polygamy difficulties that they were having with the U.S. federal government. They also sent some to Mexico, as most people know, but fewer people are aware they sent some to Canada. And the idea, I think, was A, to have people in an area outside the reach of the federal government, and B, to probably prepare places that, you know, the rest of the church could flee to if push came to shove. I think they'd had enough of being driven out of places and heading to where there was nothing. So it's a lot, in some ways, culturally at least, it's a lot like Utah in a way. You know, little small towns, fairly rural. It's probably a lot like southern Utah is. So that's where I grew up, and I'm a family doctor. I served my mission for the church in Paris, France from 1991 to 93. And I now practice rural family medicine in the little town I grew up in.
Where did you go to school for that?
I went to school. All my schooling was done at the University of Alberta, which is in Edmonton. It's about 6 hours north of where I am now, so it's about 7 hours due north of Montana. So very much the Great White North. And then I did my residency in family medicine in Montreal in association with McGill University.
Okay.
So
cool.
I speak French and English. I'm on the list of... You know, I can practice medicine in French or English, so, which, believe it or not, you even need in a little town like this.
Sure. Talk to me a little bit about apologetics as far as how you became involved in apologetics for the church.
Yeah. Well, very much accidentally, I suppose. I don't even particularly like the label apologist, not that it offends me in any way. It's just, it seems to me having a label for something that we all do. I mean, everybody is an apologist for a great many things, you know, be it our political views, be it our religious views, whatever opinions we have. If we set them out in any kind of a formal or semi-rational fashion, that's apologetics. So I always find it amusing when critics will say, well, why should we listen to the apologist? Well, they're as much an apologist for whatever they believe as I am, and so is everyone else on the planet, you know. So, but how I got into the, you know, kind of talking about attacks on the church, I was assigned by my bishop when I was in Edmonton to help a sister who had been hit with kind of all the standard sectarian anti-Mormon stuff. And so I kind of boned up a little bit. I suppose that was my first exposure. It was all pretty pedestrian stuff in retrospect, you know, just changes to the Book of Mormon text or prophets not being perfect, all that sort of thing. Nothing really too shocking there. So I suppose that piqued my interest a bit, and I maybe read around it a little bit more, but it wasn't really a big something that I spent a lot of time on. Then after I finished my training, we had a bit of an outbreak of what you might call secular anti-Mormon stuff going on up here in Canada, which was in the newspapers and stuff, which kind of got my attention a little bit more, just because it was somewhat closer to home. And so that's probably where I, without really knowing why, I began to just kind of write stuff up about this and just save it to my hard drive. Not that I had any plans to do anything with it. I just had memories of this assignment from my bishop years ago, and he was saying, go over and talk to this sister, and me going, oh, geez, I don't have anything to bring her. So I figured, well, I better write some stuff just in case anyone asks me about this stuff. And then a family member I knew said, you know, there's this group FAIR that, you know, you might actually like. So I I joined that, and the rest, as they say, is history or infamy, I guess.
And since then, what kind of things have you done for FAIR specifically?
Oh, I try to help out wherever I can. I suppose the first thing I did, I hadn't been a member of the list. You know, we have a list where we try to answer questions that people write in about. I hadn't been a member for very long when I kind of dumped this 50 or 60 page paper with 300 footnotes on the management committee. It was on plural marriage, just because we didn't have much on it. And so it was kind of one of those, well, fools and idiots rush in where angels fear to tread. And I did something on it and sent it in, and I said, you know, I don't know if this is any good. I don't know if this is any use. Tell me what you think and I won't be offended. And so some of them read it, and then Alan Wyatt got back to me, who's a professional editor, and he says, well, you know, there's good stuff here, but you need to, he had some stylistic suggestions, which I took and essentially rewrote it, and which helped enormously, I might add. And so that was probably the first thing I did is plural marriage, just, which again I fell into accidentally more than anything, just because no one was really doing much with it. So I just kind of started looking into it on my own. After that, we started the FAIR Wiki, which appealed to me enormously because I had all this stuff that I'd been saving up that I had kind of squirreled away on my hard drive. You know, I had links to various things, and you know, this was my just-in-case file, so I wouldn't be caught flat-footed if I got this assignment again. And so the wiki was a great place to just kind of dump all this material and add to it. And I'm just obsessive-compulsive enough that I kept working at it. And so that's probably been the biggest long-term project I've done is just trying to get the wiki into the shape that it is.
And you mentioned plural marriage. I think that's one of the common things that we hear people ask about as far as you know, what plural marriage was about. There's a lot of people in the church who can get stuck on that particular issue. Now, what are some of the problems that you've found people have had with plural marriage that have maybe talked to you about it, or questions that you've seen come into FAIR? What's bothering people about plural marriage?
Well, anything and everything, I suppose. We don't seem to have a problem in the church realizing that Brigham Young was a polygamist. That seems to be fairly firmly fixed in our minds. But some people aren't even aware that Joseph was. I don't really understand how that could be. I certainly believe it when people tell me they were of that view, because when I was on my mission, we were teaching a gentleman in English, and we had a couple of senior missionaries, and this investigator asked us and said, now, did Joseph Smith practice plural marriage? And I said, yes, he did, at the same time that the senior couple said, no, he most certainly did not. And I was the senior companion, so I couldn't look to my junior companion for any help here. And I said, well, I'm pretty sure he did, you know. I was pretty sure. And no, absolutely not, they said. And the investigator says to me, he says, now, Elder Smith, you know this book backward and forward. He was waving the Book of Mormon here. He says, so you tell me, did he practice it or not? And I said, well, it's not in there, but I'm pretty sure he did, but I'll get back to you. So I called the mission president and said, am I crazy? And he said, no, you're not crazy. Joseph did practice plural marriage. And I said, okay, thank you. That's all I wanted to know. So you know, and this couple had been in the church their whole lives. So if they didn't know, I'm certain they were not the only ones.
Yeah, I honestly can't remember when I first heard about it.
Exactly.
It had to have been when I was very young, but I can't. But I too have met people who say that they've grown up in the church and they've never heard about it. And every time I'm shocked, but I believe them.
Yeah, exactly. I've met enough that it does. That said, I mean, there's other much more basic gospel principles that I've met people who don't understand either. So I you know, we're all at different places, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess if there's one thing you maybe don't need to understand right now, it's probably that. But once the cat's out of the bag, then I guess that's when it can become.
That's right, because it suddenly opens this huge, huge thing that. I think as I thought about it, I've tried to reflect on why this is maybe such a problem for us, and I think it all boils down to, in a sense, that at first blush, certainly, and maybe even second or third blush, depending what's happening, it really looks like the worst things about religion, you know, about all religion, you know. It really looks like someone with a great deal of religious and temporal power convincing people to either offer themselves or their daughters or their wives or whoever to them sexually, you know. And we've all heard a thousand stories about quote-unquote cult leaders or various gurus. I myself, as a in a psychiatry practice, have treated, you know, people coming out of that sort of a situation, people who were whose parents went off and followed a rather unique, shall we say, religious path, and their kids ended up getting molested and everything by the guru, you know. So I have some personal experience with what that's like, at least from a professional point of view. So I think that's, when you boil it all down, even if people don't articulate it that way, I think that drives a lot of it. And I think it's especially difficult if, because it summons up all those sorts of images, you know, priesthood leaders in the church who maybe haven't treated us the way they should have, or women who feel they've been slighted or put down, and this looks like that, just, you know, to the nth degree. So I think that's what it really comes down to, is that at first blush, as soon as you start mixing sex and religion in any form, people get suspicious, and rightfully so, I think.
I think one reason that it continues to be a concern is just our doctrine of sealing, and I think there is that idea of, well, you know, is it technically still continuing? Is that something that can still happen even though we don't practice?
Right, is this
here?
Lurking in my future, or...
Right, what would your response be there?
Well, again, my first response would be to say, well, the people that I've heard who think that's a good idea, it's usually the guy who sits on the back row of Sunday school and rabble rouses, you know, who chooses that moment to announce how this is coming back for sure and the sisters had better get used to it, and sits back with a somewhat self-satisfied look. I always try to say to sisters, even if it did come back, that sort of person is probably not going to be the one practicing it. So you can put your mind at ease there. I think I would go back to the idea that the gospel is good news. It is always good news. It's always better than we think. So if there's something about that that troubles us, if we think that that's going to come and that that's going to be a problem in the hereafter, let's say, I would just say, you know what, that means we don't understand it. We don't get it. And I think it's the sort of thing that, if you trust God, you know, don't worry, these things are going to work out. That would kind of be my first run at it. After that, I'd say, well, you know, what is it about it that worries you particularly, and then try to target it a bit more at what their concern was. Personally, I don't think it's ever coming back in this lifetime, because if one of the things that I've become very strongly convinced of is that one of its purposes was to set us at odds or in tension with the host culture we found ourselves in. You know, Mormons were not that different culturally or politically or anything else, or religiously, really, in their values from the American society in which they were. And you, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on your point of view, you need a moderate degree of tension with your host culture to establish a new religion, to establish a kind of culture there. And I think plural marriage was a way to do that. It definitely set us at odds. Nobody liked us because of it. And yet it spared us because of distance and location. You know, we didn't get the persecutions of the 30s or 40s, you know. I mean, sure, they weren't always nice to the Mormons out in Utah, but there were very, very few deaths. You know, it was a good way to do that. So, I mean, these days, I don't think most of society would care one way or the other if, you know, people don't care about serial monogamy or one-night stands. You know, we would look tame by comparison, I think. So from that point of view, I can't ever see it coming back in this life. But that's just a personal spin on it.
Okay. Another question kind of around that same topic, then, is someone came to you and was to say, well, oh, that's God just using women for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you've read any of the journals or any of the diaries from the men and the women.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, even, you could argue that in some ways the men had things to deal with that the women didn't. I do think, on balance, that it was probably a greater trial to the women than the men, but at least the women could not be painted as lascivious or doing this for their own purposes. Nobody was convinced that the women, you know, were somehow motivated by base motives, or that this was, you know, somehow wish fulfillment on their part. But, you know, you look at what they said about Brigham Young and John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff and all the men, you know, it was looked at as this was just free sex, and, you know, the Mormons had taken the basest instincts of mankind and married it to religion. You know, and that's a very difficult thing to respond to, even if it's not true. How do you, you know, to a hostile audience, how do you convince them that that isn't the case? I think the writing of those men makes it clear in the main that it certainly was not the case. But that's a tough burden to bear. You know, I respect them for that because they really probably had no good answer to that charge at the time that would be persuasive to anybody who wasn't going to be persuaded on other grounds.
Now, last year at the Fair Conference, you gave a presentation about plural marriage. You talked about for quite a while, and during the course of that presentation, you mentioned that you hadn't started out to be the person that people would ask about plural marriage. You hadn't set out to be an expert on that, but this is something that kind of grew out of your own research. And you said when you first started to look into this, you said you had to consecrate your mind. That's the phrase that you use, consecrate your mind or your brain, before you started the process. Can you talk a little bit about what you meant by that?
Yeah, well, it wasn't at the beginning of the process. I mean, the first thing I read about it was, it's funny, all growing up, you know, my parents had a lot of books, and all growing up, my dad had a copy of Van Wagener's Mormon Polygamy, A History, you know, which was probably the first, you know, book-length treatment of it back in the mid-80s by Signature Books. And it sat on his bookshelf, and I saw it many times, and there were many times, and I read a lot, and so there were many times when I thought, oh, you know, Mormon Polygamy, that sounds kind of interesting, I should read that. And I always felt uncomfortable about the idea of reading it, which is really strange, because I will read anything. I mean, heck, I'll read 19th century anti-Mormon literature. You know, that proves my standards are not that high. And certainly nothing, my parents had never said, don't read this book, or, you know, I mean, my dad telling you not to read a book, that would be like that just isn't going to happen, you know. I remember when I was fairly young, one of my uncles came over to the house and saw a book that my dad had. It was by I think it was by Hans Kung, the Christian theologian. And he said, oh, good grief, what's your dad reading that for? And I said, oh, gee, I don't know. So later on, I asked my dad that question. I said, you know, Uncle so-and-so wondered why you're reading this book. And my dad laughed, and he said, well, you can't know a book's not worth reading unless you've read it. And so that was very much, you know, kind of the environment I grew up in. So, but I always felt uncomfortable about reading it, and I never did. I went to do it many times and just felt wrong, and I didn't do it. And so then, you know, fast forward 10 years, and I'm starting to get into this, and so I actually went and borrowed that very book and felt fine about reading it, or at least nothing stopped me from reading it. So I read, I was only the first five pages, and like I talked about at the Fair Conference, by the time I was into the first five pages, you know, the author had made it fairly strikingly clear that he regarded Joseph Smith as a womanizer well before plural marriage, and et cetera, et cetera. And so I stopped reading at that point, not because I was afraid of it, I suppose, but because I knew I had enough to chew on. And if there's one thing I believe, it's in, you know, taking your time with this stuff. Just to digress a little bit on that, I think that's the other problem people really run into this, is that they encounter something about this either on an anti-Mormon website or from a friend or whatever, and they read more and more of it, you know, kind of hoping the story will get better, and it doesn't seem like it does, it gets worse, you know, and so they're hit with this huge mammoth amount of stuff that's bouncing around, you know, and then it becomes very difficult for them to even get kind of the mental peace and clarity to sit down and start addressing these issues, because even if you start to get one, you've got 1,000 more on the back burner, you know. So right. if I did anything right, I suppose, in the whole process, it was that, is that I knew my limits, and I said, okay, you know, I got to figure out what I'm going to do with this. So, you know, I kind of thought about it for a while, and I came to three conclusions fairly quickly. One was that I didn't know enough to answer the question, you know, was Joseph Smith a womanizer? The evidence I had been presented was really very convincing, and I thought, okay, maybe he was, but if he wasn't, I certainly can't prove that he wasn't. The second thing is I was smart enough, I guess, to know that to answer that question was going to take a lot of time. It was going to take effort and work, and that, you know, I was going to have to buckle down and dig into primary sources and stuff. And the third thing I knew is that I knew that I didn't have I couldn't put my spiritual life, if you will, or convictions on hold for the amount of time that it would take to answer that question. As it turned out, it probably took me about 6 months of just reading and thinking and reflecting and whatnot before I was in a position that I could have given you a coherent answer to that question. So I was right there, at least, that I didn't have the time. You know, 6 months is an eternity in spiritual matters. So I did what I often do with such things, and that was I made it a matter of prayer. And I went in fairly, I think fairly disturbed, or fairly in a bit of turmoil, I guess, because I had read a fair amount of LDS history up to that point before my mission, etc. You know, I knew Joseph was a polygamist, and yet I had not heard this particular charge, certainly not with this evidence that Van Wagener had kind of dumped in my lap and then moved on with. So I went in kind of intending to kind of kneel down and say to God, okay, you know, like, you better make this clear to me here, or, you know, like, you know, to demand almost, if that's not too arrogant a word. Probably is a bit arrogant, but that was the frame of mind I was in, I guess. You know, to sort of demand answers and say, look, you need to straighten this out for me, or this is not going to go well. But as I was praying, I found myself doing exactly the opposite, which I regard as, you know, simply a gift of grace. It's certainly no credit to me, really. It's just what I found myself saying. And what I found myself saying was that I was going to keep my promises to him, and that I would trust him, and that even if he didn't want to tell me anything about this, or even if this was something that I couldn't resolve, that was okay, that I would still trust him, that this was not a deal breaker for our relationship, we might say. And I felt immediately much better about the whole thing, and I felt very clearly, you know, go ahead and study this out, don't worry about it, you know, do the work, do whatever you want, kind of. It's kind of a carte blanche. Didn't tell me what I'd find, or didn't tell me what I'd conclude, but so as I look back, as you say, at that point, it was that act of, like I said, consecrating my brain, you know, this to say to God, you know, you don't have to explain yourself to me if you don't want to, I don't have to have all these answers. I don't have to be this smart apologist, if you will, who's got the answer boom, 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 and can rattle it off before the critics get it out of their mouth. I'm okay, or I will accept being thought deluded or cognitively dissonant or whatever label people wanted to throw on me if that's what was required. And that's the funny thing about consecration. You know, you have to be willing to do it, and then it seems like as soon as you really do it, then you get it all back with interest. And at least that was my experience. So,
now, some members of the church that have described maybe the feeling of shock about certain things they learn about Joseph Smith, we've talked about plural marriage, or maybe it's some other thing when they learn this, there are some people who really don't seem to care about it. They can kind of go on their way. There are other people who, you know, they're not bothered at all. There are other people who let it work on them and let it bring them down. There are other people who kind of roll up their sleeves and maybe go to work. Why do you think there are so many different kinds of reactions here?
$64,000 question. Yeah, some of it may just be our innate nature. You know, I mean, we all came here with certain tendencies or certain skills or lack thereof, and so some of it may just be the way we are. I think some of it too has to do with our past experience. You know, I was, like I said, you know, growing up in a home where you have a father who'll say to you, can't know if a book's not worth reading unless you read it, you know. I mean, that creates kind of a safe space to explore potentially the difficult or troubling ideas of any sort. And so if you're accustomed to doing that, you've got a little bit of space. You've got a little wiggle room. You know, you don't panic quite as much. Maybe you can say, well, you know, I've kind of been here before about X, Y, or Z. You know, this, how bad could it really be? You know, when you sort of dive in. Like I said too, I think another part of it is the amount that people encounter. Anybody who wants to look into this, you know, you ration yourself, not because I think there's anything out there that's really threatening, but because it does take time and effort and work. And if, you know, if you can't, where I often see people at is they've just kind of been overwhelmed or buried. You know, people have thrown enough mud that, you know, people think, well, you know, even if only 1% of what I've heard is true or has no good answer, then the church can't be true or Joseph wasn't a prophet. You know, so by that time, the sheer volume of stuff has become its own argument. even though 1,000 bad arguments doesn't mean much, it's still intellectually and emotionally overwhelming, I think. And some of it, too, probably has to do with the family they were raised in and how that, or their church experience, and, you know, do they think that questioning things is bad? What's their view of Joseph Smith? You know, do they have a very idealized portrait of him? Or are they aware of some of his human foibles? And so, because, you know, if they have a very kind of picture-perfect view of Joseph or of the church, then exploring this sort of thing doesn't just require them to reevaluate or to reappraise what they think about plural marriage. It requires them to literally remake their entire view of the gospel and the church and all their experiences in it. And I think it can leave them feeling like they have no safe place on which to lay hold, you know.
So, I mean, and where can they go at that point? Someone's reached that point.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you know, at the risk of tooting my own horn, I guess, I would say the first place you go is to God. You know, if you don't have that relationship, I used to tell people in France, you know, a bunch of hardcore atheists, if there ever was some. So I guess that was preparation for this kind of thing, if nothing else.
Sure.
You know, I used to tell them about what I called first order and second order questions. You know, they would say to me, you know, why should I give up my good French wine? And knowing what I do about French cooking, that's probably a really, really good question. You know, why should you? You know, if it was English beer or something, the question might be less difficult. But French wine, I mean, that is probably a tough one, I'm guessing. And I would say to them, I'd say that's really a second order question. The first kind of order question you need to answer is there a God? If there isn't, well, then none of this matters. If there is, then you need to answer one more question. That is, will he talk to me? Well, if he won't, then he may as well not exist at all, and we're back to square one. And if he does, then we need to know what he wants from you. And until you can answer that with some degree of confidence, or at least some, you know, you have to be at least in the ballpark on that question, everything else is, in a sense, moot, you know. But that strikes some people as a cop-out. You know, they think it's me just saying, oh, you know, you just need to read your scriptures and pray. Well, no, right. That isn't what you need to do. But if you're not doing those things, then nothing much else is going to help you, you know, because spiritual life is put on hold, as I said. You know, even if you come up with a perfect intellectual resolution 6 months later, where are you going to be spiritually in 6 months?
And it seems to me, especially in Mormonism, we have a pretty strong emphasis on history itself. Our founding stories of Joseph Smith walking into the woods and meeting with God, meeting with Christ, this is something that we say happened in history. An angel brings a record of a historical people to him. This angel is part of that record. Joseph Smith translates this record. So we have this historical aspect of the faith, but then history is a very difficult thing, it seems to me, to access. So on the other side of it, we have the more personal thing between an individual and God, or between an individual, their fellow man, and God. So it seems to me that you're saying, when it comes down to it, that there are some priorities that you should consider when you're thinking about maybe historical questions, and which tie into your questions about God, too. So is that kind of what you mean, first order, second order?
Yeah, and that... And the second order questions will always, in my experience, be amenable to more than one answer. You know, I mean, people of goodwill really can interpret the evidence in more than one way. And probably the thing that's going to push you one way or the other is these first order questions. What do you think about God? What do you think about the meaning of life? You know, if you're an atheist, as many of the people who, or an agnostic, you know, as many of the people who've written this sort of history is, you know, if you believe the idea of talking to God or angels is fundamentally improbable or impossible, then it really doesn't matter what the historical evidence shows you. You're going to have to find another way to explain it, you know. And I can't say I blame them for that, but I think we should recognize that that's at work.
Another topic.
Sorry, I forgot the question.
It was basically just about first order, second order, and how
right. Sorry,
Mormonism
yes.
has the historical angle, but we also have. It seems to me the history is just as much of an invitation to seek a relationship with God and to learn about our interactions with other people. It seems to me the history is just as much about that as it is something that you might learn in a history class, or perhaps even more so.
Exactly. Yeah, I've since thought, you know, there's the part in the Book of Mormon where where, you know, Laman and Lemuel are complaining about Nephi, and they say to him, you know, what he's going to do is he's going to take us off into this far country, and then he's going to claim things about this country that we've never been to and that we can't see, you know, things about the Messiah coming and all of this. And I thought, you know, that's really what history is like. You know, it's this far distant country to whom, you know, we see through a glass darkly that we can't go visit. You know, we're at the mercy of the people who left reports and all their biases. And, you know, we could, I think, with Laman and Lemuel say the exact same thing, just as people have said the same thing about Christianity. At least its historical stuff is safely 2,000 years ago.
No, I think that's a really good point. And I guess going along that same, on that same token, Nephi's response to them is again an invitation for them to get a relationship going with God again. So I think that's
right,
interesting.
Yeah.
It kind of came full circle.
That's right. That was my point, which you reminded me of. So yes, thank you.
No, that's good. We got a couple more minutes here before we go. Maybe you can tell the listeners a little bit about what the church itself, what the gospel means to you. Maybe some of the reasons why the gospel and church are meaningful for your life, and talk a little bit about that.
Well, it means everything to me. You know, saves me from death, hell, the grave, all of it. It's what gives us meaning. It's not something I can speak about with a great deal of composure, and on the other hand, it's something that I could talk about forever, because one thing leads to another. You know, if we didn't have the gospel, where would we be? If the church wasn't true, oh my goodness, the world is a tragedy and doesn't mean much and all those sorts of things. You know, I mean, we're all slowly dying. I say that to people in medicine all the time. They'll come in worried about something, and I'll do blood tests more to reassure them than anything, and then they come back and they're all normal, and they'll say, so I'm not dying. I'll say, oh no, you're dying. And they look at me, and then I say, we're all dying. You know, you're just not dying any faster than the rest of us at the moment. And they laugh, but they get it, you know. But arguably, most of Western culture these days is dedicated to helping us forget that, you know, to either entertain or distract us from the idea that we are transient and not here for very long, and that we have it pretty good, but that most of the world does not, you know. And the gospel is one of the very few cogent, coherent answers to that issue that I've ever run across anywhere.
As far as cogency, I mean, everybody has questions about things. So what do you do with yours, and what do you advise people do with their questions?
You always keep them in mind. I'm surprised. People talk about putting stuff on the shelf. I don't so much put it on the shelf as I have a shelf next to my bed, so to speak, where I keep them and I look at them, and they're always on my mind, because it's amazing where you'll find answers to stuff when you really least expect it. You know, something that you've been wondering about or that's been bugging me. An example of that, just to pick a trivial one, is there's several places in church history where someone in the church will say, we're not abolitionists, you know, we don't think slavery should be abolished. And I always thought, my, you know, that's kind of an unusual thing for Christians or for inspired people to say, you know. And I thought, well, they were people of their time, maybe that just wasn't something they'd gotten. And then I was reading a biography of Abraham Lincoln that had nothing whatever to do with Mormons. They weren't mentioned at all in it. And it laid out kind of the how there were three broad views on that. There were abolitionists and there were slave advocates, both of whom were regarded by most of middle America as kind of extremists. And the other group was kind of this middle of the road bunch who kind of just wanted to let slavery wither on the vine. They weren't keen to, you know, disband the institution immediately with all the social disruption that it would cause down in the South and the economic collapse, etc. But at the same time, they weren't keen on it. They didn't admire it. And you know, things suddenly clicked. I said, well, again, not surprising that that's what the, because that's what most of their contemporaries were of. They weren't abolitionists, because that was looked at as kind of an extreme rabble-rousing position. In retrospect, we think it the noble one, and it probably was, you know, but it's not surprising that there was the mistake I was making, I guess, was that is I was looking at it as two things. Either you're a slave, you're either pro-slavery or you're abolitionist, but it's not. In context, there's this huge middle ground where most people were. You know, so if I hadn't had that in mind when I'd been reading, or if I hadn't been reading, I'd still be looking there. You know, now that troubles me not at all. It makes perfect sense in retrospect. So I guess that's the first step, is keep this stuff in mind, and, you know, you, to be a little bit cliche, you don't let what you do know be the be at the risk of that which you don't know. I mean, I think we all, in one way or another, if you want to really be a disciple of Jesus, faith is about trust. Why do you get married? When you get married, there's no way you can guarantee that your spouse is never going to cheat on you or isn't going to do something horrible. You marry them and you stay with them because you trust them. You take that kind of leap of faith, or you trust them to maintain the relationship. And I think it's the same with God. You know, certainly we know intellectually, or we ought to know intellectually, that we can trust him completely. But theory is one thing and practice is the other. And earth life in Mormon doctrine is all about practice. I'll give you an example of that I never understood till I went to university. In high school, I was really good at chemistry. I got one question only wrong on the final exam. You know, so I did really, really well in it. Then I went to university and enrolled in an organic chemistry class. Sorry, inorganic chemistry class. You know, should be simple stuff. The same thing I've been doing. And the first week of university, I had a lab. So I went into the lab. We were supposed to do some simple, trivial thing, you know, that I could have done on paper and calculated out to however many significant digits you want. And 3.5 hours later, I staggered out smelling of ether, you know, burned all over. I was supposed to have gotten, you know, a gram of white powder. I got about 10% of what I was supposed to get. It was this dirty brown color, you know, and it suddenly chemistry wasn't so easy, right? I knew all the answers, but to actually do it, you know, to put those formulas and those equations into practice, that was a far greater thing. And so I think life is often like that down here. You know, in the premortal world, we knew all the answers. We were all top of the class. We could give the answers easily. But you come down here and you try to apply them and you burn your hands and you stink and you probably wouldn't want to treat yourself with whatever compound you synthesize. You know, don't trust the aspirin. That's what we were doing, is we were making aspirin that day. And they emphasized in the lab over and over, now whatever you do, don't take this aspirin home and eat it, even if you think you did it right. And they were exactly right. I mean, you wouldn't have wanted to give someone the aspirin that I cooked up in the lab. But, you know, despite how lousy I did on that lab, I barely passed it. I knew far more after that short 3.5 hours about what chemistry was and what it took to be a chemist and what the chemical marvels around me, you know, what that cost, if you will, than I ever did, despite my near mastery of the high school material, you know. And so I sometimes think we're more often in that situation than we'd like to believe down here. You know, we're learning some things that we can't learn in any other way, and it's messy and it's gross and it smells, and you really wouldn't want to rely on what we come up with. But Jesus gets us out of that. Nothing but him matters. And if we trust him, it'll be okay, even when it seems like it won't.
Spoken like a true physician.
Exactly.
well done. Well, this has been fun. We've been talking with Greg Smith. You can check out last year's FAIR presentation that he gave, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Plural Marriage But Were Afraid to Ask. That's available on FAIR's website. He's
also false advertising.
It's also, yeah, it doesn't cover particularly everything, so the title. Tisk on that. But he has also published some reviews with the Farms Review. You've covered a book on polygamy. You've covered a book by Sam Harris about the new atheist movement. Anything else that you've... Are you working on anything right now?
There's something in press on DNA in the Book of Mormon, so that'll be coming soon, I'm told.
Okay, so we'll look forward to that, too. I appreciate you being a guest here on FAIR's podcast. I'm Blair Hodges.